Welcome to the Discover the Real You podcast, where we have life-changing conversations about personal development, taking an in-depth look at careers, relationships, spirituality, finances, mental health, and everything in between. The Discover the Real You podcast is here to help you live the best life you possibly can. With over 10 years of experience as a trainer and life coach, Michael A. Dickerson is fully equipped to get you to discover the real you. So with no further delay, here's the Discover the Real You podcast with Michael A. Dickerson.
Welcome to the Discover the Real You podcast. I am your host, Michael A. Dickerson, and we have a wonderful guest in the building today. Her name is Cindy Grady. How you doing, Cindy?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Glad to have you.
Thanks. Thank you for inviting me. This is amazing.
It is amazing. I really enjoy podcasts. Like I was telling you earlier, I started this podcast so I can just put people's stories out there and let people just really get an idea of what people in Oklahoma are doing and what people in this region are doing, and that people are really thriving and being successful in life, and how can we highlight that. So I really appreciate you coming on. I always knew. So when I first met you and we was in a classroom, you always know who the people who are not going to engage in class because they sit in the front. You sat in the front, right?
I did, yeah. Front and center.
Did you do that on purpose?
Yeah. Because if I sit in the back, I will just catch myself like looking at my phone or doodling. And so if I sit up front, it makes me pay attention.
Yeah.
And I like answering questions. And,
yeah, you was very engaging. And so that's why when we did that activity in class, I had you come up to class because you was always engaging. You always had really great questions, and I was like, okay, she wants knowledge, and I'm always like people that want knowledge, because you have those people when you are in class, you have those people that really want to learn, and then you have those people who like they feel like they've been forced here, and then you have those people like they're teetering either on, mm-hmm. okay, is this class gonna be really good or is it gonna suck?
And yeah.
But then they waiting for something, you know, something really good to come out so they can talk. And so, mm-hmm. but you was full force, really engaged in class. And so, when we did that little activity in class, I said, okay, I'm going to have her on a podcast when I start my podcast, because he was really interesting. So I met Cindy. She was actually in one of my mental health classes. And like I said, she was just really great, really engaged, very knowledgeable. And then she told me a little bit about her story. And I was just blown away about her story. And we'll definitely get into that. Before we get into that, I just want Cindy to tell me a little bit about what she does right now and what is her position. So you can tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. So part of what I do right now is I'm in case management. So mm-hmm. I still do that on the side. My main role, though, is the executive director of Improving Lives, and it's a brand new nonprofit just started in January.
Okay.
So we've been alive for about 6 months, and our goal is to fund the mental health services of people that cannot qualify for sooner care. In other words, they can't pay for therapy.
Yes.
And we want to bridge that gap because that's a huge gap of people.
Right.
And even in my 6 months of being in case management, I mean, I've had well over 5 to 7 clients that can't afford it.
Right.
So it's super hard to turn people away. I mean, if you're in our industry, you're there to help people. You're really not there to make money. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, money's great, but it's just not all there. I mean, we know in mental health, it's just not. And so turning them away is really hard. And with this nonprofit, we're essentially going to be opening it up for people to serve more, mm-hmm. because we would like to eliminate all clients that, you know, can't pay. We want everybody to be able to receive therapy. But if you've got a clinician that's seeing 7 pro bono clients, I mean, they're going to have a hard time paying their bills.
Yeah.
And they can't help you if they're not being helped themselves.
Yeah.
So that's our main goal. We had our first fundraiser last Thursday, mm-hmm. on the 7th. We did really well for our first fundraiser. So now we're getting the website built, mm-hmm. and we're going to start helping people.
Yeah. What kind of people did you invite to the fundraiser, and what did y'all do there, and you know, how did they feel about you starting your nonprofit?
When I talk to people about this, mm-hmm. the response is overwhelmingly positive. They are all about it. Everybody can see, you know, if you're in this field, especially the lack of funds, mm-hmm. For mental health. And if those kind of issues aren't addressed, we're seeing around the country what happens. If people don't get the help they need, what they do.
Yeah.
And so we had a very positive response. We invited some therapists because we initially, I mean, we're going to be helping them. It's a huge interest for people in this field to get involved because we're helping them. We're helping the clients too, but we're helping them get paid. So a huge interest for them. Some big players around town. We had Kathy Costello come in. You know who that is, I'm sure.
Yeah.
She's here in Oklahoma City. She's one of my new favorite people. She has an amazing story, and you would never know by talking to her.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just a powerhouse of a woman, and she came and spoke, and there was not a dry eye in the house. I mean, it was moving, and I think her in person telling that story, those people that have not been involved in this industry, it really opened their eyes. You know, what happens if someone's not treated and given the care that they need? It can be devastating.
Yeah.
And so a very overwhelming response.
And mental health is huge in Oklahoma and huge in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we're really starting to see just how important mental health is and why we need to get those services out there and why we need more nonprofits. We need more service providers. We need more agencies. We need more state funding so people can get those services that they need. Because it's just one of my things. If you don't have a good mental health, and if you're not taking care of your emotional life and your mind and your body, like, it impacts you. And so I really appreciate you starting a nonprofit and really want to do great work and want to help people, because that's really what it's all about. I always tell people, I'm in the helping profession, and that's what we do. And you was right. It's not about the money, but people do need to be compensated for the work that they do, and because we do have professionals. And so, but ultimately what we do here is that we help people. And so I really appreciate that you're doing that. And so we need people like you to take more leads. We need people to say, hey, let's step up and let's get more funding and let's do everything we can to, you know, impact our community. Because if we don't, then our communities are going to go downhill and we're going to see a lot of homelessness. We'll see even more poverty, and not getting services will impact families. And so I really appreciate you doing that. So we'll get a little bit more into that, because you are doing wonderful work. Tell me a little bit about your childhood and where you grew up, mom and dad, brothers and sisters. I know you're originally from Tulsa, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so tell me a little bit about what your childhood was like.
Well, yes, I'm from Tulsa. I've been there, aside from 2 years in Texas, I've been in Oklahoma my whole life, so about 25 years. We actually moved around a lot. My dad was in cars. Whether he was in the service center or selling, he's always been in cars. He owned a dealership at one point. So we moved around a lot. It was very hard, but now I have friends in different places, you know, and little groups of friends all around. And so it's cool now to see that. I mean, if I need to get out of town, I can usually find a friend somewhere and go stay with them for a little bit, just get away.
Yeah, we all need to get away. Yep. Sometimes we need friends to
even
do that.
Even if it's in Bartlesville. Yeah. Like, it's an hour away.
Yeah, it's an hour away.
It's not where I am normally. So
yeah, even when I go out of town to come to Tulsa, it's sort of like a little getaway, because it's like an hour and a half away from Oklahoma City, and I can just be in my hotel and just chill out.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Different scenery is powerful.
Yeah.
So my parents are great, still together. I have an older sister. She's 13 years older than me. She's got 3 kids and a husband, so our lives are very different, but we're still close, you know, as much as we can be. She's crazy busy.
Your parents had a big gap, huh?
Yeah, well, we have the same dad, not the same mom.
Okay.
So, but I mean, our family dynamic's very good. We all get along and there's no awkwardness, you know, so that helps. My childhood, so I thought about what I liked as a kid. I always made stories. Like, I always played school and house and job, and which is funny because now that's the things I want to run away from. Yeah. But as a kid, they're so intriguing.
Yeah.
I can't wait to do this, you know. And I was always the teacher or the boss or, you know, the person in charge. And I can see that in my life now.
Yeah, I can definitely see those leadership qualities, take charge, mm-hmm. you know, I see starting your own nonprofit, like it takes some leadership, right?
Well, yeah. So I do have to make it clear. I didn't start it.
Okay.
My director, Neil Ewing, started okay. it.
But you're a part of yes, it. And yeah. Yes. And you're giving a lot of input, but that's still part of leadership. So you don't have yeah. to be the founder, but you are taking a lead because you are executive director, yep. right?
Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes we don't start things, but you know, it's our turn to go ahead and make sure everything's happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like that as a kid. And music. I've always loved music, like, intensely. If I like a song, I'll play it 100 times yeah. in a day. It's weird, but I do. I like to read about why they wrote it. And I think it's so cool. Like, you can have anything going wrong or good in your life, and you can find a song, and they're not saying what you're feeling, but you get the metaphors. Like, the more you listen to it,
yeah,
and what they're saying, how they're saying it. And so I love doing that with music.
Yeah.
So.
Was there anything in school that really interested you? Like, man, you had this aha moment. You said, I would love to do that. Was there anything like that when you was a child?
Yeah. It was psychology.
It was psychology. Yeah. What was it about psychology?
So I find it really interesting how everyone's brain is completely different,
mm-hmm.
And how certain people are affected by certain things, like addiction for one,
mm-hmm.
you know, some people can handle drinking all the time and they never get addicted. And some person has one drink and they're just, it's over for them. I mean, they are addicted. And I've always found that really interesting. All the different schools of thought, different perspectives are like my favorite thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born and raised in Oklahoma. We are very, very Bible Belt state.
Right.
I've been fed one perspective my whole life, yeah. but I'm ready to move. Like, I'd like to move sometime and just see what else is out there.
Yeah. Well, so. Now that's good. I like that you said that. Now, what do you mean fed one perspective in terms of, you know, being raised in Oklahoma and being raised in Tulsa?
Because
mm-hmm. that's like the heart of the Bible Belt. Like,
it is.
You talk about church.
Yep.
Like, they do church in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
They do church in Oklahoma City, but they do church in Tulsa. Like,
yes.
you have ORU. You have, you know, big mega church pastors who send their kids to ORU. So talk about doing church. They do church in Tulsa.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
And I love church.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm an avid Life Church person. That's where mm-hmm. I go. And God has helped me through everything that I've been through. So mm-hmm. I'm all about it. But there is, you know, you should get married at this time in your life.
Yeah.
You should have kids at this time in your life. And mm. according to a lot of people around me, I'm past that time.
Yeah.
And so it's hard
yeah.
because I'm not really ready yeah. for that. Remember
I sort of talked mm-hmm. about that in class, that,
yep.
you know, there's this culture in Oklahoma, like, if you're not 25, especially for a woman, you're not 25, you don't have 2 or 3 kids, you don't have a husband, like, it's almost like, what's wrong?
What are you
yeah,
doing?
Like,
yeah.
what are you doing?
yeah.
Like, what's going on? And so, you know, I really appreciate you talking about that, because I think that is such an interesting viewpoint of where I grew up, in terms of, like, you know, build your life a little bit and then, you know, maybe settle down and then have kids. And so, you know, maybe late 20s, early 30s, then you might decide. But now it's like, you know, in this culture, it's like, you know, you don't.
Better
have those
up.
Kids, yeah,
mm-hmm.
you know, something's wrong with you. So I really like that you talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so that thread is definitely a part of the cultural thing. And it's nothing wrong with it. So for some people, it's great, but mm-hmm. it shouldn't be, you know, imposed on everybody. But it's a part of the culture. It's a part of the environment that we live in. What was your high school like? What was that like, your high school experience?
So my whole high school experience was broken half. So I was in Bartlesville for 9th and 10th,
mm-hmm.
and I moved to Broken Arrow, the largest school in the state,
yeah.
my junior year. So that was very hard. And I'd lived in BA before, but I hadn't seen those friends for years.
Yeah.
I mean, 10 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good. My junior year was the hardest, just trying to fit in. I mean, luckily I was able to join cross country and track. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, if you're in a sport, you kind of automatically have built-in friends.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
you have a place to go and a group to sit with in the lunchroom.
Yeah, that's why when my daughter went to college, I sort of knew it would be easier because she plays softball. She
mm-hmm.
plays a sport.
It
and
is.
So when you can go to college and you play a sport, then you initially already have friends when you get there. So first day you have friends because
yeah.
You start really having people that you hang out with because you play a sport. But I think the challenge is, especially when, you know, you're a college student and you go like a big part of it is the social connection, mm-hmm. being able to meet people, and it's hard if you don't have that right off. So that's why a lot of people, you know, they end up getting fraternities mm-hmm. or sororities and things like that, because they really want that social connection.
Yeah, like a feeling of belonging, right. Even if it's a foreign place, you know, if I go to this house or this meeting, that's where I belong.
Right.
So that helped. And then, you know, I was only there for one more year after that. Yeah. But it was good. Broken Arrow is huge. I still meet people I graduated with. I'm not even joking.
Yeah, like, yeah, Broken Arrow is huge. Is Jinx or Broken Arrow bigger?
Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow is still bigger? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like, I graduated with over 1,300 people.
Wow.
And I didn't know a fourth of those kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Now, who would you say is probably one of the greatest influences of your life?
That was so hard. And so I have three.
Okay.
It's all the women in my life. Right. So my mom and both my grandmas. My mom is very caring and like sweetest woman you'll ever meet. She mm-hmm. will literally do everything to help someone, even if it hurts herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm learning that as I grow up, because that's what I've done. And I've broken myself to help someone else.
Right.
And, you know, in therapy and stuff, I've just learned that you can't do that, because mm-hmm. if you're broken, you can't help anybody. So,
right.
So, you know, but that's how my mom is. And I wouldn't change that, but that's where I learned that quality. Her mom is very smart, successful business owner, pretty much her whole life. She always taught me to do the best that I can, no matter what the circumstances, which has helped me in my journey, because I've had very negative circumstances. But mm-hmm. she just said, just do the best you can. Like, be the best at whatever you're doing, whatever that might be.
Right.
And then my dad's mom, she's passed, but she's the humorous person. She always found humor in everything. She's hilarious. She's like this 4'11 little old lady that was just so sometimes inappropriate, but so funny. And mm-hmm. she just taught me to laugh about everything. And you know, like when I was a teenager and I thought I was fat, and like, oh, come on, just eat the cake. And I'm like, okay, fine, grandma, you know, like that kind of lady that drags that stuff out of you. So they've all influenced me.
Yeah. And they, you know, you took on those traits, and I can see those traits in you, and just the type of woman you are. And so I just think, you know, people, you know, we take on individual DNA who is in our mm-hmm. life. And so that's why I always like to ask that question, to just to see, you know, where did you get that DNA from? Because you see different aspects of people's lives, or you see different aspects of their personality. And so mm-hmm. Some of it's, you know, it's been there all along. And then some of it's like instilled in us over time because of the environment that we grew up. And so I heard you talk about your circumstances. And so this is why I really want to have you on the podcast, because I want you to tell a little bit about you in recovery. Because when you told me that, and you being young, and the being the person you are, I would have never in my wildest dreams thought, oh, she's in recovery. She's young. She's educated. She's beautiful. And then you told me your story. It was like, bam. And you hit me with it. And I was like, wow. I was like, came out of nowhere. So tell me a little bit about your story and your recovery process.
So my big thing was alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I started drinking at age 15. But I lived in a very small town where everybody did. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, you know, what you did on the weekends. You went and hid behind the bowling alley with your drinks and along with everybody else. And but I would sneak it into my house, and it was never an open conversation with my parents. It was like, we want you to know what alcohol tastes like just in case you're fed it when you don't know, but don't drink here. You're underage, don't do it. But I did, obviously. And that continued into using it as an escape goat, or if that's the right word, or like helping with feelings. Like, if I'm really mad, I need a drink. Mm-hmm. If I'm really sad, I need a drink. I need to talk. And that's so dangerous. I mean, if someone told me, well, it's a therapist that I work with. She said, if you ever use a substance, whether it be a drug or an alcohol, for something that it's not intended for, you have a problem.
Right.
Like, if you're using Benadryl to sleep, that's a problem.
Right.
You know, if you're using Benadryl because you have allergies, that's what it's used for.
Yeah.
And Benadryl being such a small, you don't look at that as like a street drug, right? But it is. And, you know, if you're using alcohol to escape a bad day, or you just had a breakup and you just need to get wasted and forget,
mm-hmm.
that's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's what I was doing. And so, you know, I went through some circumstances with the law mm-hmm. and having to pay for what I did. But it's brought me, I mean, I didn't really think I had a problem, right? Most people don't.
Most people don't, right. Yeah.
You know, everybody around me is doing it, so I'm no different.
Right.
But that's a very dangerous way to think, because you are not like everybody else. Yeah. No one is like each other.
Yeah.
Every brain's different. And so I'm just not the type of person that can go get drunk all the time and be fine,
mm-hmm.
you know? So yeah. I'm glad I learned that.
Yeah. And I, with alcohol, it becomes, I mean, a lot of it is, you can abuse anything, but usually abuse turns into some type of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's yeah. where it starts. When you start abusing it, like, you don't think, oh, I'm drinking every Friday and Saturday, and you think, oh, nothing's wrong with it. I don't care if I get plastered or I just get, you know, blackout drunk. It's okay. I only do it on the weekends.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and then something comes up and now you're doing it, you know, every other day. And mm-hmm. before you know it, you're doing it every day.
Yep.
And so that's usually how that process goes. Was there a drink or something that you was like, man, this is really good? So I had a friend of mine, and he's in recovery too, and he talked about how the first time he had Crown Royal, mm-hmm. and he was like, man, the first time I can remember I had Crown Royal. And he's like, I used to drink everything else, but it was something about Crown Royal. Was there a certain drink? Because I think people are always curious, like, was there something about the drink, or did you just felt like there was some pain or some emotional things going on there? Did you have that experience?
At the beginning, it was not the taste. It was disgusting. I hated it. Like, the first alcohol I ever tried was a Budweiser, and it tasted like a sweaty sock. That's mm-hmm. literally what I said when I was like, why would you ever spend your time or your money with this stuff?
Yeah.
But then it became the social aspect. So it's never really been a drink. Now, like, today, I like, you know, the taste is better mm-hmm. because I'm like, if I drink, it's going to be because I want it, not because I have to have it because of something else that happened,
right.
which is what my mind was like. But it was the social aspect, and I was a big shot person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's take a shot. It's like a group activity. Oh, yeah. You like cheers, and it's super fun, and everybody's happy for that split second.
Yeah.
And then it's awful.
Yeah, shots
taste bad.
Yeah, and shots are fun.
Yeah,
shots are fun because everybody gets into it because they's like, oh, it's just a little bit.
Yeah.
But then before you know it, you didn't took like five or six shots, and you're like, okay, I think I'm drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely the social part.
Yeah,
for sure.
Like, how were your friends with you when you were going through that? In terms of, you know, drinking every day, did you feel like you had somebody you can go to and say, man, I think I have a problem? Like, when did you discover, like, okay, I think I have a problem? And did you feel like you had somebody you can go to talk to about?
I have an amazing support system, mm-hmm. but I didn't go into anybody to talk to about it. That wasn't one of my avenues. It was, you know, everybody else is doing it, so I'll just do it with them. But the moment that I realized, like, you have to get it together, this is not the road you need to go down, is when I got caught for it. So I'm glad that happened, even though my circumstances are still inconvenient today. Right. I mean, it's very expensive.
So it was a part of the law,
mm-hmm.
something that you had with the law, and it was almost like you had that moment of where, you know, either you change your life or you was going to go down a real bad path.
Yes. Yeah. I remember I was sitting in my living room and there were papers everywhere. I mean, just covered in legal documents, next steps, what I have to complete, you know, how much it's going to cost. And I looked at that and I'm like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Because my big stint with the law was within an 8-month period. And so, you know, I just looked at it like that, exactly what you just said. Like, I have to change. Or yeah.
And I think that is so important, because the first part of recovery is you want to change.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, hey, I want to change. I always say you can't help anybody if they don't want to help themselves.
That's very true.
And they have to want to help themselves, because you can try to help somebody all day. If they're not ready to change, what do we know happened? You're just, you know. You keep going through the motions, you keep giving them money, you become an enabler. And if they're not ready to change, then they won't change.
Right.
And so one of the first things that has to happen is that person has to come to the realization, you know what, this is not good. I want to change, and I don't want my life to continue like this. And I think that's, you know, we need those aha moments to say, hey, my life needs to be different. And, you know, I really commend you for that.
Thank you.
Did, after that situation, what did you start doing to get on the path and in terms of really say, okay, I'm gonna get my life on track?
Well, a big motivator is the money that it costs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had to pull my 401k, I had to my savings just to afford lawyers and court costs and all that stuff, and you know what comes with it. So that's a, I mean, that was for me, like, mm-hmm. I've worked hard for this money and it's gone.
Yeah,
you know, it's gone.
Yeah, that'd be a motivator for some people. Yeah.
And then I looked at my bank statement, how much was I spending on alcohol, mm-hmm. and then on food to help myself after I drank that much. Mm-hmm. Like, I need so much food to recover, mm-hmm. because I'm just killing my body. And so those were big. But also what they told me to do. So I had to go to, you know, an outpatient rehab course. And I still talk to my instructors. I mean, kind of like you, like I sat up front. Mm-hmm. I was super engaged in everything. And I found it really interesting as well. Like, my story, I've lived it. So it's, you know, it's not the most interesting thing for me. But I was surrounded by people that have lived lives and struggles three times as hard as me. Mm-hmm. And they're still standing. Yeah. And what makes them still stand, and yeah. why are they there? Because a lot of people that go into those things, I mean, they are court ordered, but some aren't. They're there on their own. And right. I never would have gone by myself, mm-hmm. you know, but having to do what they told me to do to get my life back, it helped a lot.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So do you feel like in your recovery process right now, you really starting to thrive and you feel like you're flourishing? What does that feel like now?
It's
like
amazing. Yeah. And I'm in this profession, I believe, because of what I went through, because yes. I did not graduate from college with this. I graduated yeah. with an IT degree. Yeah,
that was another reason that I really thought, I was like, man, IT, you can make a lot more money with doing IT, because you was actually doing it for a while. Mm-hmm. Weren't you? What were you doing?
I worked at St. John mm-hmm. in the information security field, so I protected the medical records, essentially, because they're all electronic. And then I went to a small firm in Tulsa and did project management.
Okay.
But I never felt the same feelings that I do today.
Yeah, because I know when me and you were talking, you said, man, I wanted to really help. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like, you know, I wasn't doing my passion. I felt like I wasn't really helping anybody. And so I think a lot of people are starting to have this experience now. Like in training, when we have breaks and I'm talking to people, and a lot of people are changing careers and they're getting into this helper profession. Mm-hmm. Is what happens. I think a lot of people go to college and they like, oh, I want to make all this money and I want to get, you know, the cars and I want to get the house and I want to have these really nice things. And then, you know, and it's happening. It happens real fast. Mm-hmm. A lot of college students come out and they make really great money. But then you have like this existential moment where I have all these things and I'm still not fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
I have all this stuff and I still feel like I'm not making an impact
right.
in my life or other people's lives. And I'm starting to see that more and more and more, especially with this millennial generation. Mm-hmm. And so it's just really interesting. You said that when you told me, it was like, you know, IT and you want to come to this profession. And so I think you can give somebody inspiration. Like, you can make that transition and you mm-hmm. have to want to make it, but you also have to have good intentions
right.
about getting into this type of work. And so I think that's great that you're thriving and flourishing now. So it is becoming a passion for you. Are you starting to find that? What was it? What is it that you say, I'm getting passionate about it? What is it? What's that spark there?
Well, so I do two different things right now. Mm-hmm. So on the case management side, it's helping, you know, and a lot of times, you know, you won't see results for quite a while, or there might not ever be this yes. moment that's like, I did my job and it's over. A yeah. lot of these people, it's never going to be over. Yeah. You're just going to continue to help them.
When I was a case manager and I worked with young adults and young people who was experiencing any type of mental illness. One of the things I had to come to a conclusion with, because you want to see results and outcomes, mm-hmm. you know, you want to see behavior change right there. And when I used to work with other case managers who came in, I said, we have to look at it like we're planting seeds.
Mm-hmm. Every day. Yeah.
So we're planting seeds and they might blossom later. And it was really fulfilling. So I would work with a young man who were 15, 16, 17 years old, and they would come back 3 or 4 years after they graduated high school and say, hey, man, when you helped me with this, or when you told me to do this, or you gave me these great, great options and said, hey, you have these options, or you said, man, you have some talents or you have some strengths. And they came back later, 6, 7 years later down the line and told me that, like, that was what I was looking for. And that is fulfilling to me.
Yeah, that's huge. And the fact that you can stay in it long enough to see that, because a lot of people get burnout, which I've heard.
Burnout is real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Burnout is real in the mental health field. Absolutely is mm-hmm. real. And you have to have some good self-care.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've learned that too.
Yeah. Good self-care. Because individuals who work in this profession feel like I'm helping people and I shouldn't be seeking any help. And that's such a flaw mm-hmm. and it's such a misconception. One of my favorite psychologists, well, he was actually a psychiatrist. He said we should all seek some type of therapy.
And I believe
is that no matter who you are,
right.
We should all seek some, because we need somebody who can be objective about our life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And even like with Kate Spade and what she did. Did you hear about that?
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
I mean,
that was shocking. I mean, I just, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure, would love to live that life.
Right.
Like, you have a super successful line of $400 plus purses.
Right.
What could be upsetting? It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter how much money you have or don't have. I mean, everybody needs to talk. And I, you know, it stinks. I wish she had. I don't know what all happened with that. But, you know, it's... Everybody needs to talk. It doesn't matter your status or anything.
Yeah. And so that's really good what you're saying. So what kind of activities re-energize you? Like what type of things that really you say, okay, so we're talking about self-care. Mm-hmm. What type of things that you do to recharge your batteries?
Exercise?
Yeah.
So I was a runner in high school, and today my knee is kind of messed up from that. So I can run maybe once a week. Mm-hmm. Without having a ton of pain, but getting out, and I've been biking a lot more too. So mm-hmm. getting outside and not having your phone, that's the best. Or a watch. I mean, I've got my Apple Watch, but sometimes I have to remember to take this thing off too,
mm-hmm.
because it still interrupts me. You know, oh, you've got this, or you know, so you can't fully relax. I like reading a lot.
Yeah.
And
what type of books you like to read?
Well, I like romance novels. I'm pretty basic, but
yeah, it's okay to like romance. That's fine. You know, you're still keeping your mind going mm-hmm. and reading. And so that's good.
Yeah. And I like, I've been liking biographies a lot lately of people that I really respect, and I've always admired what they do. And so listening to their perspectives is really cool, and how they got to where they are.
Is there any biography that you read that you like, any person you can remember?
Let's see. I guess I wouldn't call this a biography, but I'm reading this book called Braving the Wilderness. Mm-hmm. My friend gave it to me. And it's about this woman that has just gone through life, and she's pretty much saying to stop trying to be like everybody else and find your wilderness. So whether that's like you're the shyest person ever and you become a public speaker, or you stay in conflict, that's one for me. So she has this whole chapter about conflicting conversations, and a lot of people like myself, I'll just back down. Like if it's not going anywhere, I'll just say, you know what, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And then months later or weeks later, I'll still be mad. I still have this internal frustration with that person that I never resolved. And so staying in those conversations and learning how to do it, that's a wilderness for a lot of people.
That's good.
So it's books that like actually help you get somewhere. I like the romance novels. They're cute and they're fun and they feel good, but like books that will teach you something.
Mm-hmm.
I love those.
Yeah. Are you now? Are you still a part of a church, and is spirituality still a big part? Does that help you re-energize too?
Oh yeah. Going to church. If I don't go to church every weekend, which I didn't go last weekend. So I just feel like there's something missing. And I also serve at the youth group at Life Church. It's called Switch. And in the summertime, it's like there's something missing, because if you stay in those meetings and those services, those kind of thoughts stay in your head. Like, when things go wrong, it's like, oh, I heard this thing at church, I should practice it. But if you don't go and you don't hear those things on a consistent basis, it's harder to pick them up and use them.
Now, before we get ready to end, what would you tell young ladies, you know, during that period that you were going through your situation, or maybe you see a young lady who is going down that path of drinking alcohol, or, you know, maybe doing drugs, or, you know, hanging with the wrong friends, and you being at the church, or, you know, right now while you're working in your nonprofit, what type of advice would you give them? What would you say to them?
I have two separate sections for that. So one is to always be intuitive to your surroundings and who you're with. And these people that you call friends, and I'm doing air quotes right now, how did you meet them? So did you meet them at a party when you were intoxicated and so were they? That's probably not going to be a lasting friendship. And it might, but all of my close friends that I hold to my heart to this day is almost a 28-year-old woman. I did not meet them intoxicated. Those are the people that are going to be there for you, because when you go to these parties and these events where there's heavy alcohol, I've never been around drugs that much. That wasn't really my scene. But if there's drug use, those people are all trying to escape something. Right. You know, they like to socialize. They might be trying to find a partner, either for the evening or for life. You know, a lot of people look for love in the bar.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that can't happen, but these people are trying to escape situations in their lives. And so they're using these substances, which makes them more outgoing. And seem like they care more. And it's really easy to fall into it. Like, this girl has got my back. No, she doesn't. I learned that the hard way. No, she doesn't. She's trying to find party friends. And party friends are so much different than your real friends. So look at your surroundings, and how are these people handling adversity in their lives? Are they turning to substances? Are they calling you and texting you and saying, I need a drink. Let's hang out. You know, that's great sometimes, but if that's all you do, those are not your friends.
Yeah.
Like, stay away.
Yeah.
And then another thing that I had to do, this was my biggest thing, is how do I deal with adversity and trial? Am I always wanting a drink? And if I'm sad, am I stopping to get wine on the way home? Like, that's what I was doing. And that's so dangerous. So just look at your coping skills. And if you don't have them, go talk to someone.
Right.
You know, and just do your best. And I know therapy is expensive. That's why I'm in the nonprofit work that I'm in. But if you can't afford to go talk to someone, I mean, church always has free counseling. Most of them do. Read, like, try to read. Like, what are you feeling? Just Google it. I mean, it's 2018. You can find so much information on if you think you're becoming addicted, if you think you're depressed. Just read about it and spend some time with yourself and stop looking to other people to fix your problems, because that's what I did. And that's so dangerous.
That's huge. You just said a lot that I would so love to unpack, but it's huge. But I think what you're saying is important is, and this is why I titled this podcast, Discover the Real You, because it has to start with who? With you, right?
Yep.
You have to have some self-awareness. You have to really understand what are my strengths and my weaknesses. You have to be a great discerner of people and good judgment. And you have to put yourself in a really supportive environment. People who's going to support you and be there for you. Here's how I define a friend. This is how I define a friend. I defined a friend as someone who I got a flat tire at 2 o'clock in the morning. Who can I call?
Yep.
That's how I define a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was to go to a lot of people right now, there's not a lot of people that don't have that friend that they can call at 2 o'clock in the morning. And they got 3,000 Facebook friends.
Oh, yeah.
And so that is what I think is really important in terms of overcoming challenges. And so that's why I really wanted you to have you tell your story, because I think what happened with you And what is great is you came to the conclusion, like, I have to change my life, and you overcame challenges, and you still are going to overcome challenges, but ultimately you're resilient and you're thriving and you're doing well in your life right now. And so I really like that about you, and when I talk to you. So but
thank you.
That was great. Just last little things, and then we'll end. So what is one thing you like about being you?
Well, you actually just touched on it. So my life has been very hard. It's been tough to be me for the last 5 to 7 years or so. But I'm still here. And I attribute a lot of that to my relationship with God, because he literally saved my life. I mean, I was going down a path of addiction, and he stopped it in a very abrupt way. But I didn't get hurt, and I didn't hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. And most of the time when people come down these paths, that happens. You know, they hurt people physically or emotionally, mm-hmm. or, you know, they might kill someone, you know, heaven forbid, in a car when they're driving, when they're drunk. And that can definitely happen, but that did not happen to me. But I'm still suffering the consequences. I'm paying for what I did, but I'm still here. And so I love that about myself.
And that's what thriving is.
Yeah.
People have to understand what thriving is. Thriving and flourishing is using my environment, whatever situation I am in right now, and maximizing that. And that's why when I talk about thriving and I talk about flourishing, that's what I mean. You're in a certain environment. Some things are in your control. Some things are not in your control, but are you getting the best out of it? Are you squeezing that orange? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what thriving is. And that's why when I talk about flourishing and when I talk about thriving, that's what I mean. And so you're getting the best out of your life based on your circumstances, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So what is one thing you wish others understood about being you?
It's kind of along the same thing, but that what I have been through is really hard to deal with. And I didn't drop any close friends, because I believe that they're not those kind of people I alluded to earlier. They're not party friends. They're close friends.
Right.
But sometimes the people closest to you can say things that they think are innocent, and jokes and comments, and they hurt, you know. And I hardly ever address them because I don't want to relive it, mm-hmm. but, you know, just little jabs about drinking or driving and, you know, little things like that, they hurt. And I'm not speaking to anyone individually, right. but just for everyone to know, you just have to treat everybody with respect, because, you know, like you said, looking at me, you'd have no idea what I've been through or what I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And that's the same for everybody else. Yeah. So if you just treat everybody with respect, and, you know, it's fun to joke around, but you have to know your limits. Like, what are you joking about? Because mental illness and addiction is not a joke. And so, you know, not just to know about me, but for other people, like, it's real and it's hard. Yeah. And so just eliminating that stigma too. Yeah.
And you can recover. Mm-hmm. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And you can thrive, mm-hmm. and be successful in life and impact your community, although you're experiencing that mental illness or in recovery from that addiction. And
right.
I think that's what we have to really put that story out there, because mm-hmm. we don't put more of those stories out there. So that's why I started this podcast. I want to put more stories out there like that. And
yeah.
so, man, I just really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I can talk to you all day long. thank you for telling the story. And so I'm sure you're going to impact people's lives with your nonprofit and still doing case management work. And it was wonderful having you on this podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is so fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Please subscribe to Discover the Real You podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Please rate or review this podcast. To learn more about training or coaching, visit www.michaeladickerson.com. That's www.michaeladickerson.com. To be a guest on this podcast, you can also visit www.adickerson.com. That's www.michaeladickerson.com.
And that was another great episode of the Discover the Real You podcast with Michael A. Dickerson. But don't worry, he'll be back next week. So keep tuning in to Discover the Real You. See you next week.